Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, everyone.
Welcome to our regular Two Mats Q&A session brought to you by the New European newspaper. Should we dive straight
in? Let's just go for it.
Question one from Tan in Hackney. So, Rishi Sunak got his way on Rwanda, didn't he? Will it help him in the election, or are the voters not going to fall for this nonsense? Thank you, Tan.
Well, I mean, briefly, yes, after a long time, no, and no.
Yeah.
So what happened this week, this last week, was that there was the final stages of the Rwanda bill, and it ping-ponged, as they say, between the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and finally the bill got through, and it will now become law. And that means that, in theory at least, Sunak gave a very butch press conference at which he said, you know, no ifs, no buts. It's pretty almost an iron law of politics that when a politician says no ifs, no buts, something will go wrong.
That's
but
right.
He said 10 to 12 weeks. And what will now happen is that there will be multiple legal challenges to the deportations that he wants to happen in July at the latest.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it'll help him in the election. I think that I mean, it's true, of course, that immigration as a general issue features in voters' lists of priorities. Although I have to say that it's this election in cost of living, the economy, the NHS, other, you know, housing shortages are way ahead.
Yeah.
But it's worse than that. I think it's because it's become a kind of weird, you know, virility test fixation with him.
Yes.
And people know it's just a tiny number of people comparatively, what, a few hundred a year at most, you know, cost 540 million.
The cost of it is just breathtaking.
It looks and is like a ideological vanity project.
Yeah.
And so my sense is that even for voters who are sort of animated by this sort of fixation with stopping the boats or illegal immigration, I don't think they're going to look at this. There's nothing worse than being both cruel and ineffective.
That's right.
So I think we'll look back on Rwanda as the Rwanda policy and the stop the boats fixation as the kind of the worst of Rishi Sunak.
Well, people must remember also that even if the flights do take off in 10 to 12 weeks, that's not success.
No.
Success is stopping the boats in his terms. You know, that's a tactic towards the strategy to stop the boats.
Yes.
This is not going to stop the boats. There's no way it's going to stop the boats.
Well, I rely on my older son who did some volunteer work in Calais for Care for Calais, the refugees area there. And, you know, the message he brought back was that, you know, refugees know all about this.
Yeah.
And if you've made your way all the way from hell to, you know, being in sight of the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yes, right.
You know, the idea that Rishi Sunak is going to send you to Rwanda, but he's not getting it through, does not deter you. A deterrent, to be worth doing, a deterrent has to obviously work. And this obviously isn't going to work.
That's right. And I listened to Zoe Gardner, who we had on.
Very, very
immigration.
Wise.
And she said quite obviously, you know, but it hasn't been said enough, is that people, like you said, they're desperate to get here. They'll find other ways to get there to avoid border force, more dangerous ways. So it's, you know, imperiling people even further. You know, people want to come here for a variety of reasons, but one of the top reasons is that they've already got relatives here. You know, so it's not going to stop them. They are going to try and get here, and I'm afraid this flight thing is one of the biggest white elephants we've ever seen in British politics.
It's a Victorian folly. Absolutely animated right. Yeah, by yeah. You know, nativism and hatred. It's horrible.
Right, thank you, Tan. I think you get the gist of where we're coming from on that one. Next question, please.
When I studied law at university in the mid-1960s, I was taught that democracy requires the separation of powers between the legislature, parliament, the executive, the cabinet, and the judiciary, civil and criminal courts, ranging from magistrates to the Supreme Court. When and how did the function of the executive cease to be that of the cabinet and become that of the prime minister, as it apparently now is? I can remember Macmillan and Heath answering questions addressed to them during PMQs by saying, "My honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Home Affairs, will be answering questions on such and such a day, and I suggest you address your questions to him, her." That's unthinkable now, isn't it? From Tim Fell. Good question. Interesting question.
It is, isn't it? Because, you know, we have adopted almost by sleight of hand this sort of presidential feel around prime ministers, and we don't operate within a presidential system. So it does cause tensions and problems, doesn't it?
It does. And it's an interesting point that Tim says we have separation of powers. Well, up to a point, actually, because the whole point about the cabinet is it's the part of the constitution, the unwritten, uncodified constitution, that links government to parliament, because we have a parliamentary system, not a presidential one. And, you know, Badgett famously called it a hyphen, you know, a buckle which joins the whole system together. And so Tim's right that was the sort of, the cabinet as a group was kind of the face of the government in parliament. And I guess it really started to shift to a quasi-presidential system in spirit, if not in institutional changes, under Thatcher, where strong leadership was so prevalent, and she'd sometimes refer to the cabinet as they. They were different to her.
Yeah. What will the vegetables have?
What will the vegetable have? the favorite spitting image joke. I think it's true that that Blair put rocket boosters under it. Yes. I remember his chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, talking openly in Whitehall about the need to introduce a Napoleonic system, which is a slightly, you know, alarming word to use. But, you know, I remember envisaged turning Downing Street and then turn left to the Cabinet Office into a sort of de facto West Wing of the White House, you know. And you remember there was all the talk about giving him a plane, you know, Blair Force One.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think that was sort of the height of it. But Tim's right that, in effect, we have a quasi-presidential system. And that's one of the reasons why ineffective prime ministers just don't get carried.
Yes.
Because no one really now says, look at the Conservative government, it's Rishi Sunak and his team. No, they just look at Sunak.
Yeah, but to be fair, he plays up to that, doesn't he?
You know, totally, yes.
I'm going to solve this.
It's all about I.
And is there any way back, do you think?
No, I think that you have to, in terms of effectiveness, you need to have a terrific cabinet.
Yeah.
And, if Labour's first cabinet could be quite good. You know, there are some very capable people in there. But the weight of attention and effectiveness will all be in number 10. The system is now, and the civil service has adjusted over the years to the idea that the prime minister's word is sort of holy writ.
That's right.
So it is, you know, we live in a de facto presidential system, and I can't see that rolling back, really.
Where it's really troubling is where that kind of holy writ starts overruling absolute common sense and reality.
Well,
like the Rwanda bill.
That's the problem. The system was not designed for presidentialism. It was designed for cabinet government and accountability in the House and, you know, people defending their departmental responsibilities. And they do to a certain extent. But you're right that, I mean, we saw the damage that in a fairly brief premiership, actually, Boris Johnson did to the whole structure of the British state.
Yes.
And trust in the British state. And that's a reflection, too, of how the person at the top, the prime minister with this quasi-presidential range and power and image and aura, can just wreak havoc.
Yeah.
And I do think that whilst I don't think it's going to be rolled back, I think at some point, and we've said this before on the podcast, there is going to have to be a revisitation of the codes and rules that hem round these roles and that of the prime minister. And, you know, in particular, the uncodified inherited evolutionary constitution we have now is not fit for purpose.
No, I think that's true. That's true. And of course, all underpinned and facilitated by a right-wing press filled with self-interest, you know.
It's yes, and I mean, another point to make, I guess, is that, you know, in ways that Brexit is hated, membership of the European Union was another check and balance.
That's right.
And in a way they absolutely hate, continued membership of the European Convention on Human Rights is another check and balance.
Because they just see it as a pain in the ass.
They just see it as, you know, they just see it as an unreasonable restraint upon the total autocratic power of the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And there's a culture around that that is worrying, I think.
Excellent question. Thank you, Tim. Next question, please, from Paul Milliken. Inspired by your discussion on phasing out the sale of cigarettes.
Such a good question.
This is my favourite question of the week. I thought it would make sense to extend the method and make it illegal to sell the Daily Mail to anyone 15 years of age or younger. We should then raise the age of legal sale of the newspaper by 1 year every year with the aim of stopping today's young people from ever taking up the paper. Ridding the country of this noxious outlet will lead to an almost immediate improvement in mental health. Surely an idea Labour should take up on winning power. Paul, you're a genius.
I think that may be the best question we've had so far
this
podcast. Yes. I think it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And although I know it's meant in a spirit of wit and fun, like all good jokes, it contains a kernel of truth, which is, you know, whilst it would be very difficult to legislate against buying the mail, the point Paul makes is a very good one, which is that the damage to people's sort of health and psyche and general well-being doesn't just come from, you know, physical addictions. It can come from information and you know,
and the not
noxious sources. So, you know, I'd also like, by the way, as a sort of secondary clause, to make subscription to the New European compulsory. as soon as you might link it to you know, as soon as you go into active work. I think you can't. It would be nice to make students do it, but I think it's a bit unfair.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because you're trapped between the sort of Voltairean, you know, defend your right to say whatever you want, you know, till the death, and the understanding that right of freedom of expression, of freedom of speech, is being abused malevolently. You know,
it
has been for a long, long time. This isn't just since Brexit and before that. This has gone on for decades with that newspaper.
What I love about that question most of all, because you're right. I mean, you're right to imply that it would be quite hard to legalise the Daily Mail, whilst at least we remain part of various human rights legislation. As a thought experiment, the reason it's such a brilliant question is it makes you think, what would a world without the mail be like? And the answer is so much better.
Yes. Yeah.
So
certainly nicer. Yeah.
Yeah, but also it would be nice not to have a newspaper that called judges enemies of the people and said crush the saboteurs.
I'll give you a little insight into how deep this runs, though, because I know that the Daily Mail, whenever they were doing, this is going back to the mid-90s and early 2000s, whenever they were doing features about ordinary people, right, with some health crisis or whatever, the Daily Mirror would just send a photographer along and would photograph them as they were in situ, you know. The Daily Mail would send a photographer, a stylist, and a makeup artist, and if the man or the woman had tattoos, for instance, they would be given a long sleeve shirt to cover up the tattoos. They would be clothed in kind of Gap kind of gear, you know, so they all looked very, very Middle England and conformed.
That's very interesting.
They all had to conform to Paul Dacre's view of what a Daily Mail reader was, whether or not they were Daily Mail readers. And it's just such an insidious insistence on a certain view of England.
It's sort of pre-digital deepfaking, isn't
it? It's totally that. And it always amazed me, because sometimes we'd get the same stories, you know, the same people in our set of photographs. They would look, you know, just like they were, working class people, you know, on an estate, whatever, no problem. But the mails, they were all polished up. And if you look through the mail now, you know, don't have to, but if you choose to, you'll see everybody looks the same, you know, and I find it creepy, you know, that
it
worldview.
It's all very odd as well, because it has its origins in Dacre's time in America, where he became entranced by the sort of picket fence,
yes,
you know, suburban American Eisenhower lifestyle,
yeah,
which, you know, is no longer really relevant to America, and was certainly never really relevant to this country. Yeah. I mean, you know, have suburbia, and we've had the, I guess there was a past when that kind of worldview was widespread.
Yeah.
But it is now really a fictitious land. I mean, it's a Narnia in one man's head.
That's right, that's right.
It's very odd.
Well, this won't be the last time we mention the Daily Mail on this podcast.
Great question, though.
Paul,
thank you, Paul.
Thank you for topping all the questions
we salute
you've
had you.
So far. Excellent stuff. Next question, please.
After Israel bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus, we now know that Iran's first action was to approach members of the UN Security Council for support, with the resolution condemning the attack on Iranian sovereign territory. Apparently, the US, UK and France rejected the idea, and Iran then chose the albeit telegraph drone attack. Do you think this was a failure in Western diplomacy? Martin and France, very good question.
Very good question. And I genuinely have no idea whether to say it's a failure in Western diplomacy or not. All I know is that if that's true and that was the sequence of events, then it seems uneven-handed to have not facilitated that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to say here, which is that, I mean, the Iranians would have made that request knowing that it didn't stand a chance. And also, you know, as a state in violation of pretty much every international law, it's always pushing it when it goes to the UN. I mean, so, yeah, you could say it was a failure of diplomacy, but I don't think, I mean, the other thing is I don't actually think that such a resolution would have stopped what happened. But what happened, and this is where I think I'm very cautiously optimistic now, was a sort of pageant where Iran took this big leap, you know, the first state-on-state attack on Israel.
Yeah.
But it telegraphed it, as Martin says, to Biden and other intelligence agencies around the world. So pretty much the Iron Dome, the Israeli Iron Dome, and help from the Saudis in terms of targeting, and the RAF was involved, and Jordan, you know, actually almost no damage was done to Israel.
Yeah.
Then Netanyahu said, we're going to respond. I mean, Biden said, take the win, you know, because... And then Netanyahu did a response, but, you know, uncharacteristically, it was a very limited response.
Yes.
So for the first time in this conflict, there was something where very little damage was done. Both sides were able to save face.
Yeah.
And everyone went home feeling a bit better. Now,
yeah.
You know, I want to be very cautious here, because this is still a tinder, this area.
Yeah, of course.
But it was the first time I thought, okay, so that lets Netanyahu make the claim that Israel is secure. The Iranians feel that they've taken action over the Damascus attack.
Yeah.
And that actually lowers the temperature,
yeah,
which may be good news for Gaza.
Yeah. Just to go back to the very top of the question, though, what is it about Israel that makes it, unfeasible for Iran to complain about their territorial land being bombed?
It doesn't. I mean,
but there is a so for instance, if any Western nation had their embassy blown to smithereens,
well,
then we would be going to the UN. There would be a crisis.
It's. But, I mean, the mistake is to think that it's only Israel that gets protected in the UN Security Council.
Yeah.
As it were.
Okay.
I mean, one of the problems of the UN Security Council is that it's because of the veto power of the permanent five members, it becomes almost impossible to do anything.
Right.
Because, you know, Russia or China say, we're not having that.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you could say it's a failure in Western diplomacy that Israel gets special treatment and so on and so on. But actually, lots of countries get special treatment. And the bigger question in all of this, which I think we need to take a step back at some point and look at, is the UN Security Council doing its job as a Security Council for the world? Or is it just a place where special interests get pleaded?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, on the Israeli front, you know, the US and UK usually stop anything nasty happening to Israel. Russia and China have their client states that they protect. I mean,
isn't it a bit anachronistic, though, that you've got a handful of nations? What is it, five members?
Five, with a permanent five.
With a veto, plus another couple who augment, don't they, now and again?
Is that yes. I mean, there's always a rolling membership. I mean, my general view, which is, again, stepping back even further, is that the UN needs a massive overhaul because, you know, it's gone from the sort of initial idea of being the post-war site of meaningful change and negotiation to being a bit like a sort of the world's biggest NUS meeting, yes. You know, and it ought actually to be, you know, an organisation of considerable might.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is now really an organisation which people use to cut deals, and it's a much diminished force at best.
My favourite UN fact is the UN building in Manhattan. You know the design of it. It's got this enormous blank wall. You know, it's like a 20-story building, but one of the walls is completely blank on either side.
Yes.
Do you know why that is?
I didn't know.
It's because no one can have a corner office, so no one's got a better view than anyone else.
Which illustrates the point perfectly.
Right. Thanks, Martin from France for that question.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This podcast, The Two Mats, is sponsored as ever by the New European Newspaper. And we've got a very special subscription offer for you, a new one, where you can get a free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover. That's right, you heard that right, folks. It's a absolutely top quality burgundy, like vegan leather, beautifully designed passport cover.
Pleather.
That's what they call it, isn't it? Pleather. To hide your new British blue.
The shame of the blue passport.
And you can get your free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover free with, and it's worth £25, by the way, free with a subscription to the New European from just £1 a week. And for £1 a week, you get all of our digital content, including the new app, which we've just spent an absolute fortune redesigning and is really, really superb now. And
so the least you can do is subscribe.
The least you can do is help us pay for that. Or for an extra £1 a week, if you like getting the newspaper delivered to your door, which I do very much.
Me too.
Every week, we will send you First Class Post, our award-winning newspaper, The New European, and that will be a saving of more than 75% on the retail price. So to take this fantastic offer, and trust me, if you like this podcast, you will absolutely love The New European, go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, and there's a link in the show notes. For that question. Next question, please. From John H. from Essex in James Cleverly's constituency, he writes, I'm 34. I was a card-carrying Tory since the age of 13. I resigned my membership post-Brexit and spoilt my ballot at the last election. I am going to say what you've got. I drew a cock and balls because I'm an extremely mature person. All right, thank you, John. I'm a natural One Nation Tory and the Lib Dems should be default position, but I've heard nothing from them and all they do is say Tories are basically bastards. I feel weird contemplating voting Labour. Should I bite the bullet and vote red, or can you recommend an alternative image to spoil my ballot with? should he vote Labour and just be done with it?
Yes. I mean, look, here's the problem, and he's not unique in this, which is that a lot of One Nation Tories feel very unrepresented now, because in September 2019, Boris Johnson deprive them all of the whip.
Just explain the phrase One Nation Tory.
Well, One Nation Tory, it didn't mean what it now means back in the day, but it has come to mean a moderate, you know, centrist Tory who represents the sort of compassionate Disraelian streak in conservatism,
right,
and you know, thinks that it's not great for people to starve to death, you know.
Right.
Okay. Radical positions
very,
like that.
Very, very controversial.
Pretty radical,
view.
You know, and often associated with being a Remainer and so on.
Right.
And because of that, in very early in his premiership, before the election, Johnson kicked out most of the significant One Nation Tories, including Rory Stewart, Ed Vasey, Dominic Grieve, and, you know, some return, but what that did was it kicked, it means there's no real center of gravity now to the center right, or heft, or a coherent response to the populist right, and maybe that there will be, but I don't see one in the near future. At the same time, and I can see from John using the language vote red, he's not thrilled to vote for Starmer, but you know, for the reasons that many criticize Starmer, he is actually a very easy person for a One Nation Tory to vote for.
Yes.
You know, I mean, he is a reliable, effective person of decent instincts with background in public service. Yeah. You may not agree with absolutely everything he says, but I think it's pretty hard to see why a One Nation Tory would be betraying at least their beliefs.
Yeah. Here's a thought experiment for you. So imagine Corbyn had ridden out the anti-Semitism drama and everything and was still the leader of the opposition.
Yes.
And was facing a general election against Rishi Sunak.
Yes.
Who would win that contest?
Sunak.
Yeah. That's true, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, I know that there is a constituency out there, and good morning, that thinks that Corbyn was robbed, and that if you add up all his polls, he's the most successful Labour leader ever. But he's patently not the most successful Labour leader ever. And I'm very glad, just as a sort of citizen, that the Labour Party is back in the game, because he risked... I always say, people talk about party's extinction. I'm not sure. I always think that's a bit dubious. But he did terrible, terrible damage to the Labour Party.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's the fact that you're obviously right that the Tories would go and absolutely win easily at a canter, probably against a Corbyn.
Yeah, I mean, he was
proof of the pudding. He made.
I mean, you know, Johnson was a lucky general in that. You know, he was up against Corbyn. Now, I think he would probably have beaten most Labour leaders, but the 2019 result was as big as it was because of Corbyn.
Very good. Thank you, John H. from Essex. Next question, please.
Should Remainers mourn Frank Field, the Brexiteer who died this week?
Well, I'm not sure Remainers in particular should mourn Frank, because he was a Brexiteer, wasn't he?
He was a Brexiteer, yeah. But I mean, I guess Emma's point is, what, you know,
should we get over his Brexit, his sympathy?
I
think we should.
And I think so do I.
I think he was, unlike Jeremy Corbyn, who there's certain analogies with Frank Field, parallels with Corbyn, in, you know, difficult, awkward, you know, seen to be very radical in his solutions to, you know, poverty and social injustice. He Field always really stood in a dignified manner, I felt, and, and was a top-notch MP. He was bold and courageous, and, you know, the fact that he I think he only lasted a year, didn't he, under Blair's kind of...
He and Gordon Brown clashed very, very strongly over what was the best form welfare reform should take.
But he was always... He seemed to me to be one of those people who came into politics for exactly the right reason, which was to to make the world a better place. And, you know, he represented a very poor constituency in Birkenhead.
For 40 years.
For 40 bloody years.
Yes.
You know, and you don't, let me tell you, you do not kid the people of Birkenhead for 40 years.
You know? And, you know, I liked him and knew him, and I was dismayed when he supported Brexit. But I still put a lot of credit on the ledger, as it were, because he had fought for poverty reduction for decades, you know, with this kind of single-minded devotion, which was really impressive. He'd also, in a way, he was one of the godfathers of New Labour because he'd fought the militants in his own constituency, you know, often, you know, in violent situations. And he'd also, he also stood his ground against anti-Semitism during the Corbyn years. So he was, you know, he was deselected over Brexit and then stood as an independent. 2019 didn't win, which was a sort of sad ending to his parliamentary career. But taken in the round, as you say, you know, he was a remarkable figure. And the thing I liked about him, which others might not, but he was very bipartisan. He, you know, he had friends all over the Commons. It was he believed in the polity, in democracy, and talking to people. And you know, that's in our sort of polarized era, that's frowned upon now. But actually, it was very natural to him to sit down in the tea room next to a Conservative MP and say, yeah, what's going on? What's the news?
Yeah,
and some people may despise that about him, but I think it's an attractive characteristic in an MP.
I liked his awkwardness. I think that that was, you know, the fact that he refused to conform, and he wouldn't, when that clash with Brown happened, he wasn't there to be you know, soft soaped.
Not at all.
He thought, right, that's it, I'm off, you know.
And he was also very, very funny.
Yeah,
was he? In private. Yeah, extremely funny. I remember, I mean, this really does date things. He came to my 30th birthday party.
No way, did he?
And, you know, he charmed the pants off everyone, just made them laugh, and, you know, it was life and soul. Just,
why was he there at your 30th?
Because I was doing sort of political journalist.
Right,
I knew him. I knew him well. I liked him.
Yeah.
I also knew that he would be the, you know, the kind of guest that would get on with, you know, relatives as well as, and he did. He was just a nice, he's a very nice guy.
Brilliant. Well, much missed and mourned by the two Matts for sure. Good luck, Frank Field, wherever you are.
Yeah.
One more question, I think. Ah. From Nelly G in Ladbroke Grove,
this London. Is a rock and roll question.
Sam Smith is going to perform at the Proms. Are the two Matts outraged, relaxed, or indifferent? Are you outraged, relaxed, or indifferent about Sam
I suppose
Smith?
I'm, of the three, I'm certainly not outraged. I'm pretty indifferent. I'm Sam Smith fascinates me because they are very successful and... risk, you know, trying to be very risque. I guess this is what makes me different, which is that I wish someone would tell them that what they're doing is not really that risque. I mean, after all, you know, the Stones were in drag in the 60s on, was it Standing in the Shadow, I think, was the single that they appeared in drag on.
The most kind of famous and ridiculed costume Sam Smith wore is that sort of black...
Yeah, the inflatable.
Inflatable thing. But that seems to me to be a less good version of what David Bowie
exactly,
was wearing.
Exactly, you know? And David Bowie was wearing some very nice frocks in the early 70s.
Yeah,
so, you know, with and, you know, then there's the sort of, some of his videos, some of their videos are very, supposed to be very risque, but then they're not as risque as Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Relax, which was, I checked this up actually, it was 1983.
Yes.
That's more than 40 years ago.
I remember it well. I was 14,
40 years ago.
I used to walk around with it. Frankie says, feed the unemployed.
I think the idea of Sam Smith at the Proms is actually, and the more I talk about it, it's completely, makes a lot of sense.
I couldn't care less because I couldn't care less about the proms. I find it, just going back to our conversation about Englishness, I find the whole kind of extravagant patriotism of it absolutely.
That's a brilliant
cringy,
fact you that know. You hate the proms. I really enjoyed that.
I just can't.
No. I just like that very much.
Every year, my wife goes with her cousin, and they sit in Hyde Park, I think, and open bottles of Pomain or whatever they drink, and sort of cheer as Jerusalem sung or whatever they sing. And I honestly want nothing to do with it. But so whatever Sam Smith does there doesn't flicker on my radar.
Godspeed, as far as you're concerned. Well, so there you go. So basically, go ahead, Sam, I think is the message from the two mats.
Go, Sam.
Enjoy prom.
Thank you, Nelly G. That's our last question from this week's. And if you've got questions or any feedback, indeed, about the show, please email us in at twomatts@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2MATTS@tnepublishing.com. Don't forget our subscription offer. You get a free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover with our fine offer, and you can get all of the New Europeans digital content for £1 a week, or you can get the newspaper delivered to your door for just an extra £1 a week, and that is a saving of 75% at the newsagent's price. What a bargain. So do that. If you like the podcast, you'll love the paper, trust me. And thank you as ever to our production team at Rethink Audio, led by Matt Hill and assisted by Ollie Peart.
And enjoy your Sunday.
Have a great Sunday.
See you Friday.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the 2-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.